Welcome back to Shattering Myths. At this time, we would normally turn our attention to correcting Pauline doctrine. But Larry, I know that you share a heart for those who come to embrace Yahweh through his Torah and who accept the terms and conditions of the covenant and become part of Yahweh's family. As I was having a conversation with Don during the third hour yesterday, that find themselves isolated from loved ones, where family and friends reject them and they feel a bit ostracized, and are looking for advice as to what to do.
Now, that is a topic, typical, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty universal. Yeah. You hear it a lot. I hear it a lot. It's probably one of the most frequent questions and emails is that I've realized that it's pretty stupid to argue with God. I'm going to go where the words lead, and where the words lead is that
it's a division process, though, and isn't that what Yahusha said? Father against son, mother against daughter. You know.
Yep, exactly. He said, "I didn't come to bring peace; I came to bring division." And it's not just separation between us and family. And extended family and society in general, but it's a separation from these human institutions.
Yes,
from,
it is
from military patriotism, from politics, from religion. It's a separation from all of those things. And if you find yourself separating yourself in terms of your allegiance from human institutions and instead to Yahweh, you're going to find yourself in a fairly small group of people. It's, you know, we talk about here how 93% of Americans recognize that the U.S. Congress is has no credibility.
Well, it doesn't.
But you can't extrapolate from there to say that 93% of American people know the truth, understand why the Congress has no credibility, and have gone so far as to embrace the Torah as the only source of credibility. Well, it's one place you've
can't
got
extrapolate that. No.
Yeah. So, you know, one place you've got 93%, which is an overwhelming majority, but then if you go the next step, is it okay? Congress, the U.S. government, is unreliable. The next step you would think would be, well, what is reliable? And while you have to first take that first step, which 93% of Americans have, recognizing that their government is unreliable, not worth their allegiance.
Well, there are no checks and balances. Those people are installed, and even if they are voted in by some weird chance, if that were true, it doesn't matter, because once they get up there, you know, I'm sure there's a full time filming crew on them, and it's not going to take long before they, you know, fall off the wagon.
Yeah, it's what you're implied here, and I do think that that while there is some graft in the American electoral process, to be sure, that most people are elected by a majority of the voters in their district. My big issue really is that the overwhelming preponderance of the voters in each district don't know enough to be voting, and if you really don't know what the U.S. Constitution says, what the economic system is in America, how it operates, what the issues are relative to United States interventionism around the world. If you're not really well appraised of the issues and know the consequences and know the various political individuals stand on each of them, and if you don't find someone who stand on them is consistently right, you ought not be voting.
Well, you just described 99.9% of the American electorate, didn't you?
Right.
I mean,
so I blame.
You know,
I blame
chairman for Alan Keyes when he ran for president.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of the Iowa caucus, I'm sure.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fairly big deal. It's one of the few big deals. Or
it's one of the things. If you win the Iowa caucus, then you have the big mo, and you are considered credible, which enables you to raise more money and lure more votes in the New Hampshire primary. So the Iowa caucus.
I sat in a it's a big deal.
It's a big deal.
I sat in a room. It's a springboard, exactly.
Right.
I sat in a room, and less than 2% of Iowans vote in the caucus.
Yeah.
So you would think you would be around the upper echelon of educated voters, you know, in the electorate.
Wouldn't you
believe that?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Ha. I sat in a room with boobs.
Yeah.
I had people. They enjoyed Lamar Alexander's shirt so well, he was the man to vote for. I mean it. I could go through a litany of the stupid. I couldn't believe I was bothering to speak to these people.
Yep. And that is the ultimate springboard to what individual gets to represent each political party in the next presidential election.
But if that's the top 2% of your voters, and it comes down to a plaid shirt or the chocolates that Bob Dole handed out, what does that tell you?
Well, even if it's the bottom two, what does it tell you? My point was that that while it's encouraging that 93% of Americans now recognize that the government institutions that they have in the past voted for are unworthy of their trust. They're disreputable, counterproductive. It's another thing entirely for an individual to be sufficiently motivated to ascertain whether or not there is any institution that is actually credible. Now, 55% know that the church and religion isn't reliable, isn't credible. But do those 55% seek out to find the one institution, the one thing, the one individual that actually is credible? And I think while it's very encouraging that the majority of Americans have taken that first step, because if you don't take that first step and disassociate from religion and politics, although very few have taken the step of disassociating from the military as well, it's the next step that does you good. All you do is you distance yourself from that which is counterproductive. Okay, that's nice. But you still need to associate yourself with that which is productive for it to matter.
There are reasons that you chose the Torah, to be, you know, the basis for what you know today.
Yes,
and there are reasons I did as well.
Yeah, what are some of those reasons? Know, and I'll share some of mine.
No, I want to. They're credible.
It's credible.
You know, when somebody tells me that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and 6 nights. I think, well, that's mythical. It's ridiculous. It's a joke. Then you come when you actually look at extant material and the words Yahweh used. Yeah. In the second line in Bereshith, better known as Genesis today, he uses the term Big Bang.
Right.
He goes further to explain relativity. And then when we come to find out, according to relativity, because as everything is more dense and hot, the light waves are much quicker, but they're shorter, and they take time to stretch. These are epochs of time. And it turns out 6 days and six nights is roughly 15 billion years, our time, and that's how old the universe is by four known measurements. The only four, they all come out to the same thing.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. That's when I realized this is all real.
Yeah, that's why I changed by the totality of what I was researching and sharing to lead with that reality, which is that time is relative. It moves at a different rate relative to the observer. On a photon of light, for example, very high
speed. By the way, there's a psalm that says exactly that.
Dodes is a pretty smart dude. I think that Dodes' inspired writings are the most profound in the universe. Now, if you look at light And the energy, the universe began as pure energy, according to, you know, as light, which is pure energy. When you're dealing with light, on a photon of light, time simply is. Time actually does not move. You're not stuck in time. Time simply exists on a photon of light. Time only begins to move and can be measured once energy cools to the point that it is possible for organized energy to become matter. When energy is diminished to matter, time begins to move. Prior to that time, while the universe, by Yahweh's definition and by the scientific Big Bang explanation, was light energy, time simply was. There was no evolution of time. It just simply was. And time, you know, when the purpose of the Big Bang, and scientists says, you know, the Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago. Well, what they're saying is that time became measurable and began to flow 13.7 billion years ago. What happened before energy cooled to the point that it could be coalesced into matter, not only do we have no idea what actually occurred at that point, but time didn't move. Time didn't begin flowing, but time still existed. And so when you understand Einstein's theory, which has been proven time and time again, that time is relative.
As an example, the sun loses 69 seconds on its clock calibrated against this planet over a one-year period of time. Why? Because it's hotter and denser.
Yeah, more energy and more mass. Exactly.
Yep.
If Larry, if you were to leave on a spaceship traveling at the speed of light, and you were to be gone for a week on that spaceship, and you returned to Earth, you would have experienced 1 week's worth of time. At moving at the speed of light, or even approaching the speed of light, you would experience 1 week's worth of time. If you come back to Earth, everyone that you knew would have died thousands of years ago. Time does not move at a consistent rate. It's relative to the observer. And when you recognize that we have an exacting measure of the rate that time flowed following the Big Bang, we know that time was stretched by 10 to the 12th power. And if you take 15 billion years, you multiply that by 365 and a quarter days per year, and you divide that by 10 to the 12th, you get 6 days. That kind of credibility is why both of us have come to trust the Torah. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were talking in the last segment about the reason that Larry has chosen to trust the Torah. We come to realize that political institutions, military institutions, other American institutions, religious as well, are untrustworthy. And you came to accept the Torah as trustworthy because it has credibility. Is it? Pretty much as simple as that, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I'd like to just present a couple of other things. You know,
sure.
Yahweh doesn't state that there was a worldwide flood. He says there was a flood in a region.
Yes.
And we have found what caused that flood, and he said it was caused by deep ocean water, if you look
welling,
at the...
Yeah, welling up, uh-huh.
Yeah,
so the Hebrew text expects it, says that a deep ocean water welling up is would be the source of that flood, and that ultimately the after the welling up of deep ocean water, that there would be rains that would also result from the
incident. There would have to be, because all that water thrown in the air from that aster that hit. Why don't you explain the Burkle crater? I mean,
The Burkle crater, impact crater, occurred 5,000 years ago, right
in Noah's lifetime by accident.
Noah's lifetime, not so coincidentally. The size of the crater and the sediments that have been found inland of the crater show that it had a wall in the many hundreds of feet of deep ocean water. It hit off of the coast of where the Tigris, the mouth of the Tigris-Euphrates River, and that the water came up the Tigris-Euphrates River and ultimately washed through the Black Sea, which 5,000 years ago was fresh water. It deepened the Black Sea by some 500 feet and made it salt water. All of the evidence of that is available, been clearly specified, and it opened the Bosphorus Straits into the Mediterranean because the Black and Caspian Seas had previously been fresh water. Now, all of that occurred, and all of it is proven, including the 12-foot deep sediments, timed to 5,000 years ago. And all available for people to look at, and it occurred exactly as God said it occurred. It occurred where he said it was occurred and for the purpose that he said it occurred. The Burkle Impact Crater. The scientist that found the Burkle Impact Crater, which is, I don't know, it's like miles beneath the surface of the ocean.
I think it's 18 miles.
Yeah, 18 miles beneath the surface of the ocean, and it's huge in diameter. It was one of the larger asteroid impacts in you know, kind of the modern history of the world. And it says, they claim, it says, you no longer need the biblical explanation of the flood. We have found what caused the flood, and it caused the flood exactly when the Bible says, so you no longer need a God to explain the flood, as opposed to saying, oh, you just found exactly what God said was going to be the source of the flood, which was this upwelling of deep ocean water. And you found that this was the mechanism that God used to cause the flood. And rather than say, well, that's some extraordinary verification of an account that most people wrote off as being mythological.
No, most amazing. People still do, by the way.
Yeah, still do. Yeah, they ascribe it to a copy edit of the Gilgamesh epic. When they don't know that the oldest extant copy we have of the Gilgamesh epic dates after the oldest extant copy we have of the Torah, and also that I've read the entirety of the Gilgamesh epic from the oldest extant material we have. In fact, it's the whole thing is sitting right behind me as I speak now, and there of the material, 99.99% of the story differs radically from the story of the flood as it's told in the book of Bereshit. There is a 0.01% correlation between the two stories, and so they want to say that that 0.01% correlation trumps the 99.9% disunity between the stories, and that one therefore came from the other. It's just stupid.
Well, especially when the Yahweh's account is extant.
Yeah, and you know, you'll have professors in academia that will say that, you know, laughing at the Torah's account of the flood, and be talking about how it was all taken from the Gilgamesh epic, and yet none of it's the flood actually occurred. When and where? God said it did. We have absolute proof that it did. Even Ballard, in his investigation, found it to be absolutely true. Welcome back to Shattering This. We're talking about why Larry and I chose to trust the Torah. Larry, I want to throw one at you that I had nothing to do with my decision to trust the Torah, because by this time I had long since realized the Torah was the only trustworthy document in the universe, but it certainly affirmed my trust in the Torah. Well, recently I took some time and analyzed Yahshua Isaiah 17 and 18 and found that God specifically positioned the fall of Damascus in the last days, and that he told us that the government of Syria would fall, and that it would fall as a result of being attacked by terrorists. And that the fall of the Syrian government to terrorists would unleash a wave of terrorism against the world. And that the direct consequence of that would be that the world would then force Israel to forego the West Bank, and that would narrow Israel at the waist, and that would invite Muslims at large, millions of them, to flood into Israel as
an act as a catalyst for World War III.
Yeah, and it goes on further to say that that the nation most responsible for this, through their egotistical rhetoric, through their navy, through their air force, through their impression.
Specifically names the navy, by the way.
Yeah, and the air force, and
well, it names helicopters, but those are primarily navy. You got to understand,
There's Apache helicopters too. But fact of the matter is that it goes on to describe about 50 characteristics of America, and it says that we're the nation most responsible for the destruction of the world. As we're watching mankind disintegrate, humankind disintegrate.
We've all heard the term oy vey. That's taken from what he said, which is what he says about America.
America. Whoa. So when you read that, and then you look at today's newspapers, and you say, oh, come on. The odds that God just got lucky, or forget about God, that Isaiah, and the 2,700 years ago, just got lucky in predicting that Israel, which it didn't exist at the time, would be reestablished in the last days, and then would be thinned at the waist, and that Damascus and Syria, there wasn't even a government of Syria at the time, that the government of Syria would fall. There were no terrorists at the time, two terrorists, and that a country that wouldn't even exist for more than 1,000 years thereafter would rise and play this massive role in the thinning of Israel at the waist, leading to World War III. And you read that, and you say, oh, yeah, he just got lucky. I mean,
well, you know, you've got Zechariah talking about a battle that will take place 19 years in our future.
Yeah.
You know, and he talks about fast flying war machines with drivers in them.
Yeah.
Now, there's only been about 100 years that we could even consider pilots and planes.
Right.
And he just happens to describe it at the time of this Battle of Armageddon. And I want to, Yasha Yahu also says this. Now, this was one of the things that blew me away. He was talking to the rabbis. You know, it was the rabbis. You're an expert on Islam, and you and I both happen to believe, you know, one of the things that Muhammad, the slave trader, said is, why do you charge the prophet so much? He was buying scripts. I love
it. I know. That's great.
But he says, on a mountain, on a high mountain, you have arrogantly put in place and fashioned, raised up and advocated your own bed and death byre. And indeed, you have quickly become witnesses for lifting up Allah, the perverse and unrighteous one, killing the living in an act of religious worship to gain favor with a deity. Now, that's Qumran Scrolls. It's Yashayu, 57:7. Yeah. Now, that was written 1,100, 1,200 years before Islam existed. Now, he just described people killing
in the name of Allah
to gain favor with a religious deity named Allah. Does that wake anybody up out there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've just finished translating Daniel 7, 8, and 9, and writing about the precise predictions about how Babylon would fall to the Median Persians, and how the Persians would fall to Alexander the Great and the Greeks, and how the Greeks would fall to Rome, and how while Rome would fall and be the most vicious of all animals, that Rome
it's written right out there.
Yeah,
that's how it fell before it ever happened.
Would rise again, and that that Rome would ultimately be the most menacing institution in the world, and would continue to menace the world all the way to the last days. And you have the Roman Catholic Church playing that role. And you read this, and if you can say, oh, well, you know, boy, okay, the guys that wrote this stuff, they were really good guessers. They were really, really good guessers. And it's just, I run probability. And you run, what is the probability that any of these things, much less all of these things...
Isn't it 2 times 2 times then 4 times 4, and then 8 times. Isn't that how you get the probabilities that way?
What you do is you say, all right, there's a prediction, for example, that that Yahusha would be a direct descendant of Dode David. And so what you do is you look at, all right, how many people could actually be a direct descendant of Dode David, which is a tiny fraction of the Hebrew population, as a percentage of the entire world's population, and you you run the math on that, and you let's say you've got it's 1 to 10 to the fourth power, and then what you do is you run the math on God predicting, for example, that the Babylonians are going to be destroyed by the Median Persians, which didn't even exist at the time. And you run, okay, so, and then he actually describes the means that they're going to use to destroy Babylon, drying up the rivers and going underneath the wall while they slept.
Which is exactly what they did. That's
right.
Exactly,
and then so you run the ads on that, and you say, okay, that's maybe 10, 1 to 10 to the 6th power. So you got to multiply those two together. Then you go to, it talks about when the Greeks would destroy.
You're getting into the astronomical now.
You get to the Greeks are going to destroy the Persians, and the Greek Empire didn't even exist at this time. It wouldn't even have been in anybody's eyes. And then it also says that not only is there going to be an individual that is going to be associated with these Greek conquests, this one individual, because this horn, this ruler, is an individual in the case of Greece, but that upon his death, and it actually describes his death as a breaking apart of internal membranes. He died of malaria. That's exactly how malaria functions. I know it because I've had malaria. And then he says his kingdom is going to be divided into four. And you have
his generals all went in.
Right.
Yeah.
Then divided his kingdom into four. And it goes on and on to describe this. Each time you have to say, okay, what is the probability that someone hundreds of years before that occurred committed this to paper? We've found extant material that verifies it was committed to paper before it occurred, and that it actually occurred the way that it did. And each one of these, you have to multiply by each other, because it's a chain of predictions.
10 to the 6 times, right. 10 to the 20 times 10 to the...
And on and on and on. And I just took, for giggles one time, 20 predictions regarding Yahusha. And I wouldn't probably do that anymore because I don't really prioritize Yahusha in my
right.
studies.
I understand.
But I did it back in the day, and I came to just these 20 predictions regarding him, that the odds of chance, just the writers got lucky fulfillment, was 1 to 10 to the 56th power. If you were to take all of the molecules in the entire known universe,
there aren't that many
of them.
I mean, these astronomical things. And by the way, since you brought up the goat with the one horn getting hit by the two horns thing in the water, no less. And of course, that's really when the Greeks, it was a water battle where the Greeks finally turned the tide.
One of the ones that was really interesting too is that he was talking about how out of the Roman Empire, the ultimate beast, the Taurus one of the last days will emerge. And you go through and it talks about, that Rome had 10 horns and that one of those horns, a smaller and insignificant newer nation than was going to merge with others. And you go through the history of nations and the extent of the Roman Empire. And he also then goes and says the same thing is true out of the Empire of Alexander the Great, that this beast is going to emerge at the intersection of those two out of a new and relatively insignificant country, a little and lowly country, if you will. And what you do is you find is, well, if you spend any time at this at all, there's only one country from which he can emerge, and it's Macedonia. And then you look at...
Oh, by the way, that nation keeps showing up on the top of many charts now when it comes to power. Yeah, very weird.
Yeah. Well, it's a tiny little country. I mean, it's in the
economy. Yeah, well, what's it doing showing up as the number one country in all these slots? It's very weird.
But it's not, it's not number one in terms of any military power, because it's got none. It's not.
No. I was looking at other international court agreements and this and that and the other thing.
Oh, yeah. The young leader of Macedonia today, he is a really clever dude. He's most of his stuff is financially based. He is a member of the Macedonian Orthodox Church, which is part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is part of the Church of Rome. The church that Constantine founded. And what you find is that he is trying to sell Macedonia as the ultimate country to partner with and as a bridge between other parts of the world and Europe, even though he can't even bridge between Macedonia and Europe because the Europeans don't want him. But it's masterful entreaties. And what I've kind of surmised as it relates to Macedonia is that if you look at the countries surrounding Macedonia, it talks about that is going to initially ally with three countries. And you look at the countries around Macedonia, I mean, what you have is this whole hodgepodge of countries that have emerged within the last 20 or 30 years out of the breakups of other countries, particularly out of the breakup of Yugoslavia and the breakup of Czechoslovakia. And so you've got countries that are just natural that need to merge because they're all too small to function. And then you look at the southern countries as part of the EU. Welcome back to Saturn. I'm having a conversation with Larry about the reasons that we have come to see the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms as credible and therefore trustworthy. I've got another for you, Larry. This is one that was affirming here more recently in my studies. If I were to ask you to name the single most deadly individual in all of human history, the person that God himself would view as the single greatest threat to a person's soul, who would you name?
Paul.
Yeah, I would too.
The phony apostle.
Correct.
Paul.
Right.
Paulus, which means he who is lowly and little. Can you imagine a spokesperson for Yahweh being named he who is lowly and little? Okay.
Yeah. Or a spokesperson for Yahweh, whose name means question him. That's his real name, Shaul. So Shaul is the individual who created the religion of Christianity. There are 3 billion people today that have been beguiled, whose souls have been effectively killed as a result of Paul. So you would think that that God would have something to say about this individual.
And well, he did. He wrote about him in Chabahuk, meaning embrace this.
And he not only
today as Habachuk or something.
Yeah, Habachuk. He not only tells us when this individual is going to arrive. When did he say this individual is going to come?
During the fulfillment of the Moed.
That would have been when the
3 days Yahusha fulfilled happened in 33 CE, and that's when he was in rabbi school.
That's right.
In Jerusalem.
Yeah, I would add a fourth one because Shavuot was also fulfilled. That doesn't make three wrong. It just means there was actually four. Were fulfilled in 33 CE, which was year 4000.
Well, he said he'd be there, and Paul said he was there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, there you go. Talk about nailing yourself.
Right. He would say that then he went through some characteristics of this individual. He said he'd be extraordinarily arrogant. Well, when you read Paul's letters, arrogant is his dominant. In fact, by Paul's own admission, he says that his arrogant he had to be demon-possessed to control his arrogance. It was so out of whack. He said that this individual would appeal to Gentiles. Who did Paul claim as his audience?
The Gentiles.
Right. Yep. He said that he would use circular reasoning. All of Paul's letters are based on circular reasoning. He said that he would be.
In fact, that's exactly what Shimon, better known as Peter today, said about Paul's letters. They talk in circles.
That's exactly what Peter, which is Shimon Kefesh, said. He said that he would be opposed to circumcision and yet be preoccupied with male genitalia. In other words, he's going to be a homosexual Who was Paul's only love interest?
The young Kimmy.
Yeah, the young Timothy. And what was Paul's number one beef with God?
That would be circumcision.
That would be true.
Yeah.
And then he actually named the person by name, and he says, his name is Shaul. And then he went one step further. He says, why is it that no one questions him? And yeah. When his name is questioned. And then God said that Shaul is not only the plague of death, that he is the plague of death, but says that no one who embraces him, no one who accepts him will be satisfied. And so here you have the most deadly human who has ever lived from God's perspective. You would have thought that God would have issued a prophecy regarding him.
He named him.
Yeah, he named him by name, Shaul.
Will be Sheol.
Yeah. Every aspect. And when you see that, you say, okay. How do you, after all of this, what are you going to do? You're going to say, well, got lucky again.
I know this, and you know it. And I've come to rely on Yahweh because of it. Look.
He's credible.
I want to digress here a little bit back to the one horn and the two horns and the goat.
Okay, go ahead.
Where it's clearly spelled out what it means. It's clear. Even in corrupted material in a Bible, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, it is.
You start getting into extant material, it's totally clear. When we decided to invade Iraq, when the U.S. decided to invade Iraq.
Yeah.
There were literally television preachers saying that this is what the one horn and the two horns were about.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It is incredibly sad how religion has twisted and perverted Yah's story and how profoundly credible Yah's testimony is. And the bottom line to all of that is, since God is telling you the truth, since he is credible and no human institution is, why don't you trust him? Why don't you spend some time and figure out what he's offering?